Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Toto, I've a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. That's right, Dorothy. This is Movie Addict Headquarters. You don't have to be a movie addict to visit here, but if you are one, it's definitely the place for you. I'm your host, Betty Jo Tucker, a very happy movie fan today, because filmmaker Halar Garcia is here to talk about Do It for Johnny, one of my all-time favorite documentaries. The Johnny in the title refers to Johnny Depp, and, of course, everyone already probably knows that I'm not very objective where he's concerned. But I'm sure that anyone who loves movies would also enjoy Do It for Johnny. It chronicles the search for Johnny Depp by Halar and his partners in order to give the actor a guitar made especially for him, as well as a script inside it for a film Johnny Depp would be perfect to star in. But before bringing our guest in, let's see how Nikki Starr, my wonderful producer, and Jazz Shaw, my excellent co-host, are doing this afternoon. Nikki, are you ready to hear more about Do It for Johnny?
Yes, I cannot wait. Very excited for this show.
I know you've been excited all week when you heard that we had Halar on the show. And what about you, Jazz?
Oh, I've been looking forward to this and doing a lot of research on it and it does sound exciting. I mostly want to find out if there are any restraining orders involved.
maybe we'll find that out from Halar. And by the way, he's on the line right now. Congratulations on your fascinating documentary, Halar.
Thank you, Betty Jo. I appreciate you guys thinking of us and having us on. It's really nice of you guys.
Well, we're just so delighted that you could work us into your schedule, and it's just going to be so much fun to talk about this documentary. We have lots of questions for you. I think Jazz wants to start things off today, so go ahead, Jazz, with the first question.
Oh, thanks, Betty Jo. Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind, Halar, is how did you decide to take this experience and make the decision to turn it into a movie project, per se, because it kind of sounds like the real life adventures of Halar and Scott. You know?
I'm going to stop you for a minute, Jazz. We're getting some feedback. I'm just
Sorry
wondering if anyone has their speakers on. If they do, if they could turn it down.
Not me.
Okay, Nikki, do you know what that might be the feedback that we're getting? Are you getting that too?
I can hear it. It sounds like his phone.
Okay, does it sound all right now? Jazz,
well,
are you there?
Speaker.
Okay. Well, maybe it's just my phone, but okay. I'm sorry, Jazz. Please excuse me. Go ahead with the question.
I don't know. Taylor, did you catch that in the first go? Or
I caught part of it, yeah. How did we, you were asking how we actually decided to document the process?
Because yeah, the actual like project itself, because as I said, it kind of sounded like the real-life adventures of Halar and Scott, you know. So what made you decide, rather than focusing on the movie you wanted to do with Johnny Depp, to make a documentary out of this?
Well, ultimately what it was we had written a biopic, right, about Scott's life. He's had a pretty colorful life. And we wanted originally to produce it at an independent level. But as the scope of the screenplay got bigger, we kind of started to realize that there were a lot of things about the screenplay, not just the budgetary scope of it, but also rights and other things that kind of made it impossible to do totally at an indie level. We did think we could do it at a low budget level, and at that time it was before Pirates had hit. So we actually, filmmakers do, you have fantasy meetings where you sort of sit around and you go, what if this and what if that? And at that time, Johnny Depp was obviously a big star, but he was also notorious for doing indie films, things like Dead Man and you know, really small films. You know, we looked into it, and the other reason he fit the bill was because he was actually a, you know, a staunch musician who had actually moved to L.A. to become a musician or to continue his music career, not to be an actor. And so, you know, obviously he's extremely talented, has sort of a dark side of his own, and has been through a lot of this, and we thought, you know, this is the guy. And so as we got into that and started to try to really understand how this could be possible, Pirates hit. And
wow.
That elevated him to, you know, at that time, 20 million, and I think he's up to 30 now. But so when our challenge became, you know, sevenfold harder than we had originally planned, the first thing that came to our mind being filmmakers was, you know, if we're going to try to do this, we should film it. Because in actuality, this could be really difficult. And so that's sort of how the idea for a documentary about it was born. I mean, it is sort of a natural evolution, you know. We realized it could take a long time to actually present him with this guitar, this sort of sculpture that was sort of the embodiment of film and music in one art piece. And just in knowing that it could take a long time and that the obstacles that were ahead of us were pretty steep, we decided it just needed to be documented.
Well, you mentioned Scott, and maybe some of the listeners don't know who that is. And and this is the person that the movie that you wrote, not Do It for Johnny, but the movie
right.
Narcophonic. Is
Narcophonic,
that?
Yeah. Yeah, it gets a little complicated, but basically the lineage is this. Scott Baxendale is a friend of mine. He's had an illustrious career in building guitars for a multitude of famous people. He's also curated at one time in the 80s the Hard Rock Cafe Museum, back when all of this stuff was really, really good stuff. Like, he refurbished Hendrix's Flying V and John Lennon's Rickenbacker and both of Buddy Holly's guitars and things like that, real historical artifacts in the rock and roll
wow.
in the rock and roll world. And so
indeed.
Yeah, Scott had a really, really amazing career, all of which was consumed by his own internal battles that led him into drugs. And so within the period of 1 year, Scott went from owning a million-dollar company at that time and building guitars for everybody from Willie Nelson to John Cougar and all these other people. By the end of that same year, he was living in a homeless shelter and robbing crack dealers to support his own habit. And so at the end of his adventure, he was facing 90 years in prison. And then that's sort of where he ended up, and then there's some, you know, some, I hate to take it apart, but there's some third act things that did come along and sort of save the day. But interestingly enough, I thought it was an amazing rock and roll story that was really from the working man's perspective. That's what I loved about it. It wasn't about a rock and roll icon. It wasn't somebody that we look up to and aspire to be. It's someone that we sort of are. You know, it's someone who shares the same dreams of, you know, of doing what we love and or being famous or breaking out of our everyday routine. And so in that, Scott is a very accessible character. So we
maybe
wrote
some of
the
price that comes with that, too, it sounds like, you know, the
absolutely.
Price you pay for that kind of journey you go on to get to that point.
They're good.
And
it's different.
And that was the screenplay. That was the screenplay.
That was the screenplay.
Put
we felt it was compelling. And
yeah.
So then what we did was we decided to get it to Johnny Depp. And then we thought, well, you know, we're going to be vying for his interest like 1,000 other people. And most of those people are more powerful than us and have a lot of, you know, connections and, you know, studios and producers and directors. So how can we stand out? That was our question. How does our little script stand out? How do we, you know, we know we're not going to be able to pitch him. We're not going to have time to sit down and talk with him. So we thought that what we would do is appeal to him on an artist's level. And that Scott, the man who this film is about, this talented luthier guitar builder, would build Johnny Depp this one-of-a-kind guitar. And to elevate the stature of the sculpture and the meaning behind the object, Scott was going to embed a copy of the screenplay in the back of the guitar so that the screenplay could be removed and so that when they were together, they were this embodiment of film and music. So, you know, it's been interesting. And so our hope was that we would be able to, in a limited amount of time, which we were pretty sure that would be the extent of what we got with Depp if we ever intersected, we'd be able to hand him this guitar and walk away and let his love of music and film spark his own interest and do the rest.
What a great idea. And it sounds like a role that would just be perfect for Johnny Depp, too. And I was just impressed very much. But I'm so naive, you know. I just
As were we.
Yeah. but the plan that you came up with, I thought was, you know, it looked like something that would definitely work. Do you want to go through what were the who were the people that you were planning to contact along the way that could help you? I think this is an interesting part of the story,
yeah,
too.
Well, there's a huge amount of responsibility that comes along with taking this guitar that I never realized when Scott actually handed it to me and said, go do it. I mean, the guitar is easily a $5,000 guitar, if not more, considering the way it's now connected to the documentary. So we, early on, we said, you know, we can't just hand this to anybody. We can't throw it in the mail and send it to a house that might be Johnny Depp's house. We
no.
can't. A lot of things we couldn't do. And so what we did was we researched and we looked into people who surrounded him, people who knew him, people who we thought we could connect with, and we came up with four people that we thought we could hand this guitar to. One of them was obviously Johnny Depp. If we could hand it directly to him, that would be the ultimate.
Yay!
Yeah. Secondly, was Robert Rodriguez,
yes.
The director, because he is also a musician, and he started out his career much like us, and so we felt there was maybe some relatable connection.
And he worked with Depp, didn't he, on Once Upon
Correct.
A Time
and
in Mexico?
At that time, he had just finished Once Upon a Time in Mexico, so we thought, you know, Rodriguez was another, you know, really good choice. We thought his agent obviously was a good choice, because that was the normal route to try to contact his agent and do that. And then lastly, one of our biggest rules is that we did not contact or accept information from the internet and people who were helping us and following us. And we would not accept information regarding Johnny Depp's family. So we didn't want to contact anybody in his family. And the only person that we felt it was appropriate to contact in his family was his sister, who owns a production company in Hollywood with him. She actually works in the business of finding and developing ideas for their company, Infinitum Nile. So those were the four people: Johnny's sister, Johnny's agent, Robert Rodriguez, and Johnny himself. And other than that, we would not hand it to anyone.
And the documentary, I just love the way you show how you how you went about contacting these people, especially Robert Rodriguez, and also your travels to the Academy Awards ceremony. I mean, that was just wonderful. So tell a little bit about that, because that is just such a fascinating story.
That particular part of the documentary was one of the more grueling, because we did decide that we were going to try to intersect with Johnny like on a street level, like the way everybody else does, except we had a huge banner, and we were going to try to see if he would, you know, catch a glimpse of us at the Academy Awards when he had been nominated for Finding Neverland. And so on our way out there, we thought, well, maybe we can get out there, we can get out to Texas, make a loop, contact Robert Rodriguez, and try to increase our chances to see if for some reason Rodriguez would speak to us and thought it was an interesting idea, maybe he'd contact Depp, so that we could hook up with him when we went to, you know, pie in the sky, it seems like now, but
I was all for it.
Let's give it a shot. So we did. And that was a pretty grueling one. I had the flu really bad. It was ridiculous hot in Texas, and obviously cold at night. It was just terrible. We could not get anywhere near Rodriguez, nowhere near him. He was busy doing two films at that time and just could not be reached. Our producer couldn't get an interview. We couldn't get past the publicist. So we eventually were able to hunt down the actual studio lot. Our producer, Darcy Grabowski, was able to pull some business records from public domain in Texas and find, you know, Troublemaker Studios. So we got there and we actually left some information behind for him in case, but we never did hear back. And then the following trip from there to L.A. was just harrowing. It was, I mean, one thing after another. And once we finally did get there, we had a few days to try to, you know, maybe contact Johnny Depp or his agent or his sister before the Academy Awards. But as we arrived, we got news that Hunter Thompson had committed suicide.
Yes.
And at that moment, after that trip, we just – it was hard to make the choice because you're caught in the middle. You know, you dedicate so much to what you're doing, but at the same time, there's limits to what's appropriate and what's not. And at that moment, knowing that Depp was very close to Hunter Thompson, we chose not to try to intersect with him in any other way. So we just thought we'd wait for the Oscars where he was going to be, and there were people out there, and that would be about the length of, I mean, that would be the most appropriate thing we could do. But we didn't want to ask him for time or, you know, during that time.
Well, I wanted to sneak in one quick question about the guitar, if I could, because I'm
sure.
One of the people, and I'm waiting to find out. I haven't gotten to see the film yet, and I'm so much looking forward to it now. I looked at one photo. It wasn't really very clear. You mentioned the guitar with the script kind of built into it or hidden into it. Was it obvious that the script was in there? Was there any chance that if you only got a quick chance to hand it to him that he might have it and not find the script?
No, there's no chance. The back of the script, what it was an electric guitar. There was no door that covered it. We actually had it buckled in with a set of leather buckles. So if you looked at the front of the guitar, you would look at it and it would look like a normal guitar, and the guitar is playable and, you know, fully functional. If you flip the guitar over, the script is embedded in the back on display.
Yeah,
there'd be almost no way to miss it.
And that banner, I love the banner that you guys made when you went to the Academy Award ceremony. Depp, we have your guitar.
Yeah, it was a huge, like, 12-foot banner that needed to be carried by two guys on poles. And unfortunately, the side of the street we ended up on, and we learned a lot about the Academy Awards as well. We're out there that there's a lot of staging that happens that when you watch it on TV and you go, oh, that's how it's set up. Once you get there, you realize that the setup is quite a bit different than you realize.
This must have taken a lot of drive and determination to take this whole thing through. Just out of curiosity, from the time that you decided that you were going to do this and you made the guitar and got it ready, and then you had to go on this hunt. How long did that whole process take before the whole thing played out, you know, to the end?
You're talking about
spoil.
To the end of the documentary, just over 3 years.
Wow.
And
about
no matter
14,000 miles of driving.
14,000 miles and all of these obstacles. And what impressed me the most was that no matter what obstacles stood in your way, you ran into some officious assistance, you ran into bad weather, lack of money, and ill health. You and your group just continued on your quest no matter what was put in your way. And I think that's, you know, the film is a testament to your dedication and perseverance. And I was just wondering, what was your greatest challenge in filming Do It for Johnny? I mean, there you had a lot of challenges, but what did you consider your greatest one?
Well, I think overall within, like, the main skeleton of the work, the greatest challenge is obviously, you know, being a relative nobody trying to intersect with, like, the ultimate of somebody's. But as far as, like, the one specific thing, you know, I think being able to follow a dream that requires so much attention while still trying to maintain your everyday life and the lives of everybody who's in on it. Like, Scott's life was interrupted, you know. Darcy, our producer, and my fiance, her life was literally, I mean, the busyness of her life was literally doubled, if not tripled, in order to make this documentary. And then Jeff Deal, our videographer and sound man, he went with us tirelessly and never complained and never got paid and did it for the experience, you know. And I think the hardest thing is to find people who are dedicated enough to do something that, you know, most people just feel is the most ridiculous thing. You know, how can you be running around in an RV looking for someone who will probably never talk to you when the bills are due?
And you guys just put your lives on hold, I think.
Well, actually, we put them – well, actually, it was a simultaneous existence. We couldn't really afford to put them on hold. You know, we did. We went out and we did it. We came right back, and everybody went to work and had to double-time their work in order to make up for the time they were gone. That's one of the reasons Darcy didn't participate in a lot of the trips, and she missed out on a lot of the adventure because we needed her here. And, you know, she was it was a lot of work, and I think that's probably the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge, as with most things in life, comes from within you. You know, it's like, can I do this? Will I continue to do this? Will I keep getting up no matter how many times I'm knocked down or disappointed? And, you know, and ultimately when you conquer that challenge and you build that ability to keep getting up, you find that success really isn't that difficult. It's really about that. You know, it's about action and reaction and constantly moving forward no matter what happens.
You've been in a number of different creative fields, you know, from your background, including music and other things. I'm curious what drove you to get into film. As a sort of failed filmmaker myself, I always wonder about that because these are all difficult rows to hoe. What drew you to that?
First of all, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Did you finish your films?
Yeah.
Then you didn't fail.
Hi, good. Good for you, Halar. I've been trying to tell Jed that.
Oh, well, you have no idea. That was the best thing you could have ever said to him. Thank you.
Yes.
So, you know, being driven to be a filmmaker, for me, I was a musician, and for many years, you know, mostly a lyricist and a singer, and for many years, I felt compelled to write. I mean, I always have, and I think most writers say that, but I think what happened was when I sort of graduated or stepped away from music or whatever you want to call it, I think I looked at myself and I analyzed why I was a musician. And ultimately, it was because I was telling stories within that music. And so the one thing that's always sort of steadfast is that I really want to communicate stories, whatever that, in whatever medium that was. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I guess I must have just looked up at film and said, you know, that is like the ultimate storytelling. I mean, it's everything. It's the closest you're going to get to making real life, you know,
absolutely.
And that's what drove me.
Absolutely. And what a great answer. And I'm wondering where you get your drive and determination. I wondered that all the time I was watching this wonderful documentary. Where does that come from, Halar?
Well, you know, I think that's a blessing and a curse. You know, it's one of those things where having the drive to finish something is really great when you finish it and you can like pat yourself on the back or others do so. But having an obsessive drive to finish something when you're at the beginning of a job or, you know, or a project, it can be, you know, can be good and bad. I mean, it's something that's, I think, built into certain people, a lot of times artists. And, you know, what some people call drive, other people call obsessive compulsive disorder.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So it's like not being able to finish until, or to stop until something is finished. You know, it's an attribute, I guess, but sometimes it can weigh pretty heavy on other parts of your life, including relationships and your own peace of mind and stuff like that.
It certainly worked to your benefit, though, while you were doing this film. And I think we should take a minute here and see if there's any question or comments from the people who are participating in the chat that Nikki would like to share with you, Halar.
Sure.
Nikki, anything from the chat you'd like to bring up?
Well, there's not too many questions from the chat room. However, I did bring up a review, and I know Jazz has it too. It was really an amazing review on the IMDb about this movie. And I just want to read the last like four sentences, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
This documentary made me laugh and cry. I cried with empathy and with pride. I laughed with pure joy at the group's triumphs. The group's perseverance and dedication are to be admired. The directing and editing are both brilliant and witty. I recommend this documentary to all for its message of never giving up on your dreams.
Beautiful.
It's just, it is. And I can't wait. I want to see it right now.
I know. And I think that's the reaction that most people, I think, are having to this documentary. Didn't you pick up some awards on the festival schedule, Halar?
We did. We picked up, we went in on the 2006 circuit. We floated around and we made it into, gosh, what was it? It was Sonoma Valley, Santa Barbara, Rainier, Hollywood, and Vail, I believe, here as well in Colorado. And I think it was Rainier. In fact, I'm sure it was Rainier where we won Best Documentary. So we were very thankful for that. It was really nice of them to consider us and then ultimately choose us.
Well, where can people see your documentary?
Well, I act it out in the park as a piece of performance art every Thursday. No, I'm just kidding.
I want to see that.
was getting ready to write down where.
Where at?
That was good.
No.
Nikki and I
so
are
what we've done
down
is
there this weekend.
Yeah, we signed a foreign distribution with a company called Maitland and Moving Pictures, who's moving it around the world, we hope. They just signed Poland, and I believe they're working on Japan, so it should be available outside the United States and Canada. We, after long, long courtships with different companies and different things, we decided to hold on to our own domestic rights. So we will be distributing ourselves in the U.S. and Canada, and that will be happening right after the first of the year. We wanted to release in time for Christmas, but there are some editing and some other post-production things that need to be done concerning licensing that has to happen before we can do that. So it looks like it's going to be after the first of the year and probably hit, hopefully, pretty big in the summer.
We always hear that distribution is one of the most difficult aspects of the project and can be one of the most daunting and depressing for filmmakers.
Absolutely. It is. It is because, let's see, how can I put this? The thing is that unless you have a film that really has was a super festival powerhouse, where we were lucky enough to be in some festivals and won one, but we were by no means a festival powerhouse. And so because of that, you know, the profile of the movie is small. And you would think because, you know, it has to do with Johnny Depp in some sense that maybe that would help it. But what we didn't want to do is capitalize on his likeness, because it's sort of really not about him. It's more about us trying to get to him. And so we didn't have that real huge distribution interest that a lot of people thought we would have. And so unless you have those things to drive the film, a lot of films just get lost in distribution. They end up on a catalog somewhere, and they end up with a lot of debt that the companies want to recoup before they start paying you. And at the end of the day, by the time that gets paid back, the shelf life of the movie is over, and it just doesn't come to pass. You know, no money's really ever made off of it.
Right,
you know?
And I think that's a great idea that you're holding on to the rights and planning on distributing it yourself. And I hope you have a big premiere in Denver, because I can make it to Denver.
Oh, we'll let you know for sure.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah,
well, I can make it to
New
York City, so you know, make sure you make it down there too.
Well, even if you could, if it can, you know, be distributed on DVD and people could order a DVD, that would be
yeah,
great.
and that's most likely the model, because especially now, see, what we've come to find is that there are literally hundreds of Johnny Depp fan sites that are powered by fans, you know, hundreds of them, web rings, fan sites, all kinds of things. And we can market directly to those just by getting on their line and letting them know it's available, you know. And so we're sort of an anomaly in that sense. Like if you were trying to distribute any indie film, the first thing is you have to get people interested in it. Even if you're willing to pound the internet all day,
right?
People still have to look at it and go, why would I buy that? And there's some really good new models that Amazon is supplying, and also a company called Tanaki, like direct ship. They, you know, you just send them your file, and, you know, they'll send one off. There's no minimum. You don't have to stock anything. So people can log on and buy your thing, and that company will print it, shrink wrap it, barcode it, and send it to them, and the filmmaker doesn't have to see it at all.
That's right.
And eventually we'll have to get you on Netflix, of course.
Yeah,
I hate to toss out a really generic question, but just personally I always find this interesting. When you were starting out and looking for your own style, were there any particular filmmakers that influenced you, like when you set your own direction? Like early on I was very taken with like Jan Svankmajer, just doing shorts and things like that. But was there any sort of guidance for you that you found in earlier people?
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, as far as like feature stuff, which is not related to the documentary, I've always been sort of attracted to anybody who breaks the rules early on to establish their style. And I think it's more about that trait that I find attractive about certain filmmakers rather than specifically their style. So, I mean, like, I look at people like Tarantino and John Waters and, like, even Spielberg in his early days as the same sort of having that same trait, you know, and even George Lucas, who now is a very commercial filmmaker, you know, in his early days he was not. So it's more that trait that I'm attracted to in filmmakers.
I love anybody who lists John Waters just because he is so darn scary to this
day.
Yeah,
he's a scary man. Scary, scary man. But
I recognize no rules, John Waters, yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Totally. And as far as documentary filmmaking, I had never made a documentary, and so nor have I studied them, and at that time had not seen very many, barring things you might see on Discovery. But as far as like a real feature narrative, something done, with that format in mind, I hadn't seen a lot of them. I was really into dramatic feature work and stuff like that I gravitated towards. So this was sort of an experiment for us as we made this documentary.
That's amazing. I never would have thought that because it just held your interest. Well, as I say, I'm such a big fan of Johnny Depp's, and you mentioned that he's got so many fans, and that's quite a draw for your movie, any movie that would be connected with Johnny Depp. Why is it that we admire Johnny Depp so much? What is it about his acting that you admire and would travel so far to try to get him interested?
It's a combination of things for me, and I think, and I don't get, obviously I can't speak for the world, but I think that there's a certain amount of like lovability that people have for Johnny Depp for a lot of reasons. One, because despite all of his good looks, he has never defaulted to his good looks for his roles or for his fame. I mean, some he looks crazy, some he doesn't, but that's not why he's attractive as an actor. You don't look at him and go, wow, that's a good-looking guy. I'm going to go see that movie. You go because you know he's going to be good, and you know what I mean? And it's like you just know that he's going to take the character somewhere that another person wouldn't. And so I think he's always had that sort of that truth about him. We just look at Johnny Depp and we go, you know what, this guy could have sold out a long time ago. And real early he got out of 21 Jump Street because that's all he was eye candy, and it didn't challenge him. And I think he gained a lot of respect for that move. And ultimately it took his career longer to become a superstar the way he is now.
Right.
But even though it took him longer, he did it with so much more. He demands a lot more respect for the way he did it. Because
and it seems like he did steer himself towards some roles where he was made up to be a less attractive character and not
absolutely
just eye candy, and that probably shone through.
That leads up to another question we were discussing at the time, though.
For the original project, the script that you were delivering in Do It for Johnny, and one hates to focus on the negative, but after going through all this, if you didn't manage to get Johnny Depp, have you considered any other actors that would fill the bill at this point, or has it sort of evolved into something that now is wrapped around him?
Well, there is a list of actors, and here's kind of the way we look at it. There are a list of actors who also play guitar, but it wasn't just, I mean, no, that was not the only criteria, and ultimately that's why Johnny Depp ended up being at the top of that list. And so we do think it's sort of wrapped around him, especially since, and I don't want to ruin the documentary, but the way things ended up, there is this sort of attachment that will always linger until such time as, something is until there's closure. I just don't think we could go to anybody else now. And,
good. I'm so glad to hear that.
I just don't. And maybe that is the one thing that keeps this film, which, even without Johnny Depp, the film itself, I mean, the idea and the concept and the story, I think are really compelling, and it almost seems a crime to lock it up and say no one's going to see it unless it's Johnny Depp. But I see a lot of ethereal connections now because of the art of the documentary and the connection to Depp. I just feel like somewhere, sometime, it's all going to work out. Even now, I maintain that.
I love that feeling, and I have that feeling, and I'm going to keep sending all the vibes in your direction and in Johnny Depp's direction.
You.
And Jazz, you mentioned how Johnny Depp even goes to extremes to maybe look not so attractive on screen. But he is the actor today that that the camera loves the most, no matter what he does. He looks good. And he puts so much detail in his performances.
Oh, we had another question coming in from the chat, if we have time to squeeze it in.
Sure.
And somebody wanted us to ask our guest, when moving from paper to film, when going from a book or the original script that's written? How do you maintain the purity, and how important is that? And I suppose that sort of ties into, do you lean towards a lot of freestyling? You know, if something is working better on film than you envisioned it on paper, you know, how much freedom do you think you have to go there?
Are you talking about Scott's story? Obviously,
right.
I would assume. Cause
yeah.
Well, in my particular circumstance, I sat down and did interviews with Scott. I didn't go from any written material. I went straight from the horse's mouth, as they say. I do think it's important to relay the truth, and especially you do have to dramatize. That's the problem. You have to dramatize and you have to consolidate, especially when you're working with a 30-year story into an hour and a half movie. And so really the ability to do that is essential. And if you do have the good fortune to work with the person who's lived through it, it does make that process easier because they can stress to you what is important, what cannot be deleted or consolidated for dramatic effect. But ultimately, you must do those things. And it can be a challenge, but, you know, as long as you relay the spirit, our rule was dramatize without fictionalize. And if you stick to that, then you can push the bounds of some things and you can downplay other things as long as you don't change the spirit of the character and the journey, you know, that the character takes.
Wow, I may have to steal that. That's fantastic.
Right. That's a great answer. And I don't want to waste this little tiny bit of research that I did right before the show because I'm so upset that I haven't been able to see Johnny Depp in a movie this year other than the Hunter Thompson documentary, and he was only on screen for a few minutes. But look what he's got coming up next year. He's going to be playing John Dillinger in Public Enemy. And that's a Michael Mann movie with Christian Bale and Billy Crudup. Also, Billy Crudup plays J. Edgar Hoover. I can't believe that. Christian Bale plays Melvin Purvis. He's also got The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. That's a Terry Gilliam film, and it's a fantasy mystery. And then in 2010, he's playing the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland, a Tim Burton movie. In 2011, he's in a animated movie called Wrangle, which I don't know anything about. And Nikki, this is for you. In 2011, Johnny Depp is going to play Barnabas Collins in Dark Shadows, and Barnabas Collins is a vampire. And I remember last week you said you wanted to see him.
My wife is listening in the background and just screamed, "Oh my God!"
Yeah, and that's Tim Burton. That's Tim Burton movie too. So I just can't wait for that. And then the other one that's announced is Sin City 3. So that's a pretty heavy schedule. But I'm going to be sending the vibes to keep something open for Narcophonia, right? That's the title.
Yeah, Narcophonic. We'll sneak it in there right between a couple of Tim Burton movies.
Yeah, Narcophonic. And that'll be a great movie, too.
Hey, Laura, I don't want to spoil everything for everybody, but, you know, without giving away the end of the documentary, I did want to ask before we totally run out of time, and my God, it goes by so fast. Are you still moving forward right now on the project for Scott's story, or are you working on anything else in parallel that we can look for coming from you?
Well, interestingly enough, the documentary and sort of its resulting effect got me a manager, and that manager ended up getting me an agent. And so I'm now currently, for about the last 8 months, with ICM.
Great.
And so some of my other scripts one is being currently sold to a rather large animation company. And also
excellent.
I'm working as a writer on a few treatments for other pretty large companies that I'm really happy about, and hopefully those will pan out. It's a pretty rough market. So Scott's story, Narcophonic, is sort of waiting, and I believe it's sort of gestating. I don't believe it's dead. I believe, a lot like Depp's career itself, it's waiting for the right time to become the superstar that it is.
Maybe you and Depp will just meet at the right moment in time, and it's going to turn into something we'll all be talking about.
Exactly. Or he might say, "You're that guy that was chasing me around. Call the cops."
You're the guy I got the restraining order on. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, there were no restraining orders. We were very mindful of.
I was only kidding. I was only kidding.
That's a happy ending, definitely.
You didn't think I heard that, did you?
Well, you've written about 7 scripts, haven't you, Halar?
At the time of that release of the bio you're referring to, I had, and Now I've written about 11.
11 scripts. Wow.
Yeah, and you know, some are good, some are bad. But the one that we just sold is a pretty cool big apocalypse film, large animation, large tentpole thing that's looking like it might have a multi-million dollar budget and very cool. I'm very happy. So. I don't want to jinx it, but it's going well.
That's definitely exciting, and one of the things too that adds to your filmmaking ability is all of the experience that you've had in music. And you mentioned that you've been a vocalist and a musician and a songwriter, and you also had a record studio at one time. Is that correct?
Yeah, we still own a recording studio here in Colorado. My fiance and I, Darcy. It's a building that has a recording studio on the upper floor and video studio on the bottom floor. And this was all being put into works when we were trying to do the documentary. So this should have taken place back in probably 2002, and it never did. And so we've just opened recently, and things are going well.
We have to rush in one more question from Betty Jo's fans here.
Sure.
Because you have this parallel background, the question was asked, do you plan on in the future writing any of your own music for any of your own film projects? Do you want to combine those two areas? Because music's often a big stumbling block, you know, for producers who are trying to make films.
Good question.
I would definitely consider that, although I must say that scoring a film is a particular skill that not all musicians, and possibly including myself, not all musicians are born to do. It takes a very specific type of emotion, and it takes a very specific type of skill set to actually score to film and create moods in small segments. So I would love to do that one day. I'm not sure that I possess the skill. I probably will tackle it one day and give it a shot, but there are much more qualified people out there to do that. But it is a good question, and I you never know.
Because
Thanks.
Music is such an important part of
it is.
Part of film, so you would be able to tell whether the music that is being done is going to work for your film, even if you don't do it yourself. And I think that's really important. Yikes, our time is almost up. I'm always so surprised because
no kidding,
it just flies. No, I'm shocked that our time is almost up. But Halar, I just have enjoyed you on the show today so much. You've been such a great guest. Thank you so much. And
well, thank you so much for thinking of us. We really appreciate it.
It's our pleasure, and on behalf of Jazz and Nikki and our listeners, I want to wish you great success with all of your exciting projects.
Thank you
and
so much.
Please keep us posted, okay?
I will.
We'll be watching for you and, directing all of Betty Jo's fans your way whenever you're doing anything.
I have to say this. I love you, Darcy. That's all.
Oh, and we love Darcy, too, for everything that she's doing for you.
For putting up with my madness.
That's right. The crazy Halar Garcia, who's doing all these wonderful things with a lot of support. This is Betty Jo Tucker giving a big shout-out to the folks at Blog Talk Radio for their support and connection with this show. Thanks to Nikki and Jazz for all their help, and to everyone who listened live or to the archives or who took part in the chat. We really appreciate it. Please come back next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for another lively discussion about movies. Now mark your calendar, for we'll be talking about the movies and performances receiving the most attention during this year's awards season. In the meantime, check out our film reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. As usual, here's the talented A.J. Daniels to take us out with a song dedicated to all our loyal Blog Talk Radio listeners.
much I love you. Then you'd be forced to love me too. If you knew how much I adore you, you'd stay with me and be